Is September 22nd. It's our second class of the year in this series that we're doing on providence and theodicy in Chazal. In other words, in the writings of our sages from the time of the Mishnah and Talmud. And the first class we had last week introducing what Chazal say about this subject of providence and theodicy related specifically to rabbinic material, material of the sages, that is to say, Midrash, that relates to the book of Job. And that's our segue from last year. In other words, dealing with the subject of providence and theodicy by way of Midrashim, by way of expounding the book of Job. And we did 90% last time of what I wanted to do on the book of Job. We only have 10% left from last week's class. So we'll sum up the 90% that we did, and we'll go on to the 10% that we did not do, and then we'll go on to today's class. That's the program. So the first thing we said last time was that there is an opinion among the rabbis that Job never was and never will be, never existed. There was no such a person. It's a mashal, it's a parable. And another opinion that's a modification of that, and this is Reish Lakish, Rabbi Shimon ben Lakish, says that Job as a person existed, but the things that the book says about him didn't happen. In other words, it's basically, the book of Job is a historical fiction. It's based on a certain person that once lived, but the things it says about him did not take place. The book is a mashal, it's a parable, and it comes to teach us that this man Job was so great that had the things described there taken place, they didn't, but had they taken place, all this terrible suffering, he would have been able to stand up to it all, just as the book describes, and God would have rewarded him for that. And we said the point of this midrash, at least for our purposes, is to say that the terrible suffering without good reason that the book of Job describes, that didn't take place because it couldn't have taken place. It couldn't have taken place. In other words, this opinion seems to hold that in the world we live in, there is not, there doesn't exist, and there couldn't be the type of injustice described in the book of Job. That's not reality. Just wipe it out. And if you think the book is about bad things happening to good people, that's not what it's about. The book is about something else. The book is about showing you the greatness of a particular man, how great human beings can be. Job was that great. It's not about providence and theodicy. And if it had been about providence and theodicy, it wouldn't have described things the way it did. All it describes about the injustice happening to him was just background to create the situation of showing how great he was. But that's not reality. In the world we live in, there's justice. There isn't the injustice described in the book of Job. That was the first midrash we saw. Second midrash we saw, bringing a different point, actually bringing the same point from a different perspective. This second midrash said that Job was one of the evil advisors of Paro. Job was one of the evil advisors of Paro. And without going into all the background, why did the Midrash say that? Because the Midrash is disturbed by what the book seems to say, that there's no justice in the suffering. Answer, there is justice. He was being punished, not for a sin of commission, remember, but for a sin of omission. His evil was that he didn't speak up against Paro. But his evil nonetheless, and what the book describes, is punishment for sin. Ah, that's not what the book says. Well, this is an interpretation that cannot live with what the book says. It's too terrible. And it doesn't reflect reality as the author of this Midrash understands it. The reality is different. The reality is, if there is suffering, there must have been sin. Okay? That was the second Midrash we saw. And then we saw two more Midrashim that went in the direction of the next world. Job suffered, but it wasn't, again, it wasn't unjust. He was suffering for his few minor sins that he had committed in order to wipe the slate clean so that he can be rewarded in the next world. And again, the approach says there is justice. It's not in this world, but there is justice. And the way of finding justice in the book of Job is not by saying it didn't happen. That's the first midrash. not by saying that he really did sin terribly, but rather by saying that he'll be rewarded in the next world, and what happened in this world is just because it was for the few and far between sins that he did commit. Ah, that's not the pshat of the book. I know, but the author of the Midrash is struggling with the book and has to come up with this interpretation, which is clearly not the simple reading of the book. That was the third approach we saw. And the fourth approach we saw last week was the most original, intriguing, and that was about the scapegoat. Remember the scapegoat? And that basically said that God is like a shepherd that has a flock, and the flock is being attacked by a wolf or a bear, and the shepherd gives the bear one of his strongest sheep to deal with so that the rest of the sheep could escape. And after they all escape, then the shepherd will go back and save that one strong goat that is being attacked by the bear or the lion or the wolf. And as this approach explained itself in the Midrash, it said that the Jewish people were evil in time of Job, and they deserve to be punished, and God has to do justice. He has to punish them, but he doesn't want to punish them. He wants to let them escape, the Jewish people. So what does God do in order to let justice take place? He lets the Satan, he lets justice deal with Job as a representative of the collective, right? It's not individual providence, it is collective providence. And it's just because Job is suffering for sin, not for his own sin, but for the rest of the Jewish people's sin.
Why one for all?
Because we're one for all.
Yeah.
Thank you for saying it. Okay? And that approach we saw in two different very fascinating midrashim.
Sorry, it was Gililon's every 2-week briefing.
Oh, okay.
If somebody else was there, I don't know, but that's what it was.
Okay, okay. It was the usual.
It was the usual.
Thank you.
Okay, bye.
And after those four different approaches, again, first one, it didn't happen. The second one is that Job did sin terribly. The third is that Job was to be rewarded in the next world. And the fourth was that Job was a scapegoat, a representative of the Jewish people. And the fifth approach is that of Rabbi Yochanan. And here we only scratched the surface last time. And that's where we are beginning right now, with Rabbi Yochanan. And if we're looking on last week's source sheet, it is the bottom, or the middle, of the back of the middle sheet. Right, there are three sheets. There are three sheets.
It's the Genesis 30.8, right?
In Midrash Rabbah, Genesis 30.8. Okay. That's where we left off last time. And at the very end of last time, I gave some background to the life of Rabbi Yochanan. And that's where we'll start right now. Mm-hmm. Rabbi Yochanan lives in the land of Israel. He's in the first generation of Amoraim, which means it's about the year 180-190. Until he lived in about 280, he lived about 90 years, Rabbi Yochanan. He lived a very long time. And he's in Tveria, Tiberias. He's the Rosh Yeshiva of the Beit Midrash of Tveria. Rabbi Yochanan, the Midrash says, his father died after Rabbi Yochanan was conceived, and his mother died in childbirth. He was an orphan. Rabbi Yochanan was born into a rabbi, rather well-off situation, but he gave it all up to study Torah, and many of his years he lived in poverty. Rabbi Yochanan had 10 children, 7 boys and 3 girls, and they all died in childhood.
That's ridiculous.
Rabbi Yochanan contracted scurvy in midlife, and for 3.5 years he was bedridden. So we're told about him. And he was able to be cured of his scurvy, and he went on to live a very, very long life. He remarried, had children again, boys and girls, and he died approximately at the age of 90. That's the life of Rabbi Yochanan, and it's been pointed out by researchers that Rabbi Yochanan's life parallels to a large degree, the life of Job. Job also had seven boys and three girls, and they all died in his lifetime. Job also suffered like Rabbi Yochanan did, and vice versa. Just like Rabbi Yochanan, so Job, it was all lost, both the material possessions and the children, but it all came back again. And they both lived a long life, happily ever after, with sons and daughters being born to them in their old age. And perhaps that background can explain some of what we find Rabbi Yochanan saying in the literature of our sages about this subject of providence and theodicy in the book of Job, because we can assume that Rabbi Yochanan identified deeply with the reality of Job. And certainly Rabbi Yochanan would never say that the book of Job was a mashal, because he knew it was real. He lived it. He experienced it. And if anyone would say that a person such as Job, who was so righteous, could never have experienced that suffering, it doesn't happen, Rabbi Yochanan would just take the bone of his 10th child out of his pocket and say, "This is the bone of my 10th child. Don't tell me there's no suffering in this world that's not deserved, because I don't know of any sin that I committed that would bring such a situation upon me."
Do we know who wrote the book?
We don't know who wrote the book of Job.
Do we know when it was written?
We don't know very well when it was written.
It just came out of the loft.
I didn't say that, but we don't know exactly when it was written. Right. And it's really... That's behind us. I'm gonna go on. So Rabbi Yochanan, in the Midrash that we ended with last time, says concerning many, many seminal events in the collective history of the Jewish people that they were predestined. Avram wasn't who he was because of his deeds, because of any reward. It was predestined by God that Avram would be the founder of the Jewish people. Moses was predestined to be a redeemer. Mordechai was predestined to redeem the Jewish people also. That is the way it's set up. It's not because of reward and punishment. And Rabbi Yochanan says that also concerning Job, that he was predestined to suffer. Now, I don't know exactly what that means, but I know what it doesn't mean. It clearly doesn't mean that he suffered for his sin. That's the point.
Question.
Yes.
Does Rabbi Yochanan ever discuss free will?
Yes.
And predestination and free will and the conflict between them?
Right.
Okay. Just wondering.
Yeah, so I debated with myself if we should go into that, and I thought that's outside of the
okay. Well, that's preview. What I just I'm not asking what he said. I'm just asking if he did.
A little bit we'll see of that when we start talking about astrology.
Oh, okay.
The Midrash at the bottom of the page is from Midrash Rabbah, Genesis 57:4. Another interpretation. Abraham entertained misgivings, being afraid of suffering. In Genesis, we notice, I don't have the Tanakh in front of me, it's not important, that at one point Abraham...
Do you want to look at?
Well, I have in my briefcase.
Right,
it says Abraham was afraid. And the Midrash debates, what was he afraid of? And God says, Al tira, don't be afraid. But what was he afraid of? So this Midrash says he was afraid of suffering. Okay? Said the Holy One, blessed be He, to him, "Thou need not have fear, for ready he has been born who is to receive them." In other words, your suffering will be experienced not by you, but by someone else. Utz, his firstborn, and Booz, his brother. What's going on is the following. There is, right at this point in the Torah, a description, a genealogical tree, that includes the birth of someone by the name of Utz. And the rabbis noticed that name Utz is the same name as the town that Job lived in. The beginning of the book of Job. That's what it says, where he came from. Eretz Utz, the land of Utz.
How do you spell that?
Uzi.
In Hebrew?
Anyway.
Ayin Vav Tzadi.
Ayin Vav Tzadi.
Utz. And the rabbis make a connection. They said that if at the time of Abraham there was someone born the name of Utz, and if Job lived in the town of Utz, it must be that Job lived in that same time when that boy was born.
So he could say, Ani Utzi.
Okay. So it turns out, according to this approach, that indeed Job actually lived and existed, and we know he was at the time of Abraham. And this Midrash goes one step further. Not only did he live and exist, not only did he live at the time of Abraham, but it's saying that he received all the suffering that Avram could have received.
Buz and Uz are his nephews.
Okay, thank you.
They're Nahor's children, his brother Nahor.
They're in Haran, right? They're in
I've been in biblical Haran. We had dinner there.
I indeed had forgotten where they are. So, when did Job flourish? Rabbi Shimon Bar Lakish said in Rabbi Bar Kapara's name, the days of Abraham, for here it says, Utz is firstborn. Well, it's written, there was a man in the name, land of Utz. Okay. So the point here is the following. That this Midrash says that the suffering of Job was already preordained in God's discussion with Abraham. Again, it's not because anything that Job did. He just had to be that way. Without going into why it had to be that way. But it's not because of sin. And I'm bringing this Midrash as part and parcel of the previous Midrash in which Rabbi Yochanan said that Job's suffering was preordained, just in order to point out that it's not a matter of sin. It's not deserved. Okay.
The implication is not that it was Abraham's sins that Job was suffering?
We don't know if it was... We don't know if Abraham had a reason to fear he would suffer. This actually is debated by the commentators, that why does God say to Abraham, do not fear? Why was Abraham in fear? Is it because he did something wrong? There are those who say perhaps he did something wrong in killing people in the war of the four kings against the five kings. Perhaps he did something else wrong. Perhaps in the Akedah he did something wrong. So we don't know. Harry?
Isn't it kind of pushed for someone to come along and say that all these people were predestined after it happens? Very simple to say that. What gives them the right to even say something like that?
I think that it's a very good question. It's a matter of struggle with the text of the book of Job and struggle with the reality in which we live. We're searching for solutions.
Let me just finish.
Any solution we find is one that's not written in the text and it's not written in reality. It's a reconciliation. It's an effort. It's a limited human effort to make sense of the world we live in and make sense of the texts that are our ancient texts. Are they good solutions? Sometimes you might say the solutions are worse than the problems. And you have a right to say that. And indeed, many of our rabbis criticize each other's solutions to one of the most intractable issues in Jewish and all of religious philosophy.
Yeah.
I thought you could say anything predestined.
We're saying things, again, in order to try and make sense of the world we live in.
If
it doesn't make sense for you, then turn the page to another solution and see if that one makes sense. And if none of them make sense, at least we will have fulfilled the mitzvah of Talmud Torah, and we've understood the way others have understood the world we live in. If it doesn't make sense for us, at least we understand, we have a larger understanding of how others grapple with this reality.
But the point I'm making is, and maybe I'm not making it clear, is the reason they use this excuse that it's predestined because they don't have an answer.
Well, that's what he said. So that everybody has different answers.
But it's not an answer. It's not an answer. It's a cop-out.
Well, Harry, I'm trying to say...
That's why you're saying, I don't know.
Harry, but what I'm trying to say is that you're right. It's not an answer, but it's a refutation of someone else's answer. It's a way of saying, I don't have an answer, but I cannot accept your answer that the suffering is because of sin. And that's an important statement to me. So Jay, and then Mo, and then Bruce.
Well, of course, Harry's point is absolutely spot on, and you mentioned yourself that it's flawed. What I find is so flawed that how could these rabbis, who are knowledgeable about the Torah, probably have an encyclopedic knowledge of it, come to a conclusion that is so flawed, even though it's a refutation? I mean, it is just so way out, right? I mean, it is such an extreme.
Let me just say this suggestion.
Yes.
It's as if one rabbi said X, and Rabbi Yochanan says anything but X. Anything but X.
Okay. Can you then? This is in the text here at the bottom of the next to last page that you quoted. Reinterpret what the sentence is: "Thou needest have no fear," because I don't understand that sentence. And you said that it meant, well, tell me what you think it means or what it's supposed to mean.
And that means, Avram, don't worry. The suffering that you're supposed to get, I'll give to someone else.
But wait a minute. It says, already he has been born, meaning somebody else is alive, right, at this moment. Who is to receive them? What's the them?
The suffering.
You might want to interpret it that way.
We know that them means the suffering.
Yeah.
Suffering is here.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I won't say
it. Who's got the brass ring on that one? No, what? I'm sorry. Are you finished, Jim?
Yes.
What are the different, you know, all of this is very imaginative, and so it's part of creative writing, maybe. But one of the differences between Yochanan's comment and the others is that he doesn't even touch the question of whether Job was a real person or not. He doesn't even necessarily deal with the story of Job as an allegory.
I didn't bring the sources. Rabbi Yochanan seems to hold clearly that Job existed.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
Yeah.
Most right.
Yeah.
And it didn't. This midrash we just read at the bottom of the page that doesn't have Rabbi Yochanan's name on it, but this midrash does say that he actually did exist at the time of Avraham.
This would mean that Job was of the family of Abraham, so he's part Hebrew, that he's part Jewish at least.
Well, as Mo pointed out, he's a nephew,
yeah.
Right? And those who stayed in Aram Naharai, Mesopotamia, they are distant cousins of us, but they're not part of the same line,
right?
Bruce?
I think we're getting bogged down with labels. We're getting bogged down with labels again. What I think you have put together on these pages are opinions of different people. Those opinions are called midrashes, and you can accept them and not accept them. So maybe if you changed the wording and said, this is an opinion of another rabbi, you're taking it away from, when I hear the word midrash, oh goodness, there's some big, great meaning to it.
Okay, Bruce has said important things. These are opinions, stances, efforts of different rabbis to grapple with an issue that is intractable.
From different generations.
From
too.
Different generations, indeed. Yeah. Indeed. Dorothy.
You know, we used to have a member who would always say that half the stories from our Bible came from stories around the campfire that were brought along by people over the years until they were finally written down. And a lot changes when that happens. Kids' game where you talk to each other and it goes around the table. So it's not uncommon for later generations to try and rationalize through the midrash some of these stories. And it is not unlikely that some story developed after Abraham, and that Job came, somebody created or heard a story about Job. and then they try to put together that he lived during the same time period to put a thing around Job. Who knows when the story of Job came up? It could have been before Abraham, it could have been after Abraham. The bottom line is that when our books were starting to come together and people were starting to write things down and create the history of the Jewish people, both of these stories existed, and they incorporated them into our books. Whether it existed 25 generations before Abraham or 5 generations after Abraham, really is immaterial. God created the earth long before Abraham
was on the planet. Okay.
And so I think I agree with Bruce that we're running around in circles trying to put a time period on Job. Who cares?
Okay. Good that Dorothy said that. Just let me point out, when the Midrash says that Job was an advisor of Paro, or the Midrash says that Job lived the time of Abraham, please, please don't read that as an effort to fix historical reality. Mm-hmm. Read it as making a theological statement in the language of history, the metaphor of history, but it's not a historical statement. Of course, we don't know, and it doesn't matter. What matters, when one rabbi says that Job was an advisor of Paro, that doesn't matter historically. It doesn't matter. But it matters theologically, because it's making a statement that Job did something wrong, as we saw last time, being an advisor of Paro. But it's a theological statement, that it's not a historical statement. For certain. But of course, the fact that it's written in historical language, and then you don't like the history because you don't know where it came from and you don't believe it has any basis, don't throw out the baby with the bathwater. Read it as a theological statement. Okay? So let's just finish up here from last week with these statements of Rabbi Yochanan that I already hinted to. Or perhaps we even read them last time, I don't remember. Babylonian Talmud, Tractate Baba Batra, page 16a. Then the Lord said unto Satan, Hast thou considered my servant Job? For there's nothing like none like him in the earth, right? We remember that verse from the beginning of the book of Job. Said Rabbi Yochanan, I'm at the end of the third line. Were it not expressly stated in the scripture, we would not dare to say it. God is made to appear like a man who others try to incite him against his better judgment, and he yields. If you read the first two chapters of Job, as we read last year, it looks like God is a weak master who is connived and who gives in to a wager with this Satan. And against his better judgment, God lets the Satan do what he has to do to Job.
He's conned.
Yeah. Rabbi Yochanan doesn't try to re-explain it, doesn't try to reconcile it. He just says, that's what it says, and it's terrible. I cannot understand it. I cannot live with it, but I can't live without the Tanakh. I accept that that's what it says, and I don't know how to deal with it. And again, I'll say what I said 10 minutes ago. Rabbi Yochanan isn't willing and isn't able to explain these things away because he lived the reality. He lives with great suffering, lost his children, had scurvy for so many years, and he finds no meaning in it and no explanation for it. So don't try and explain away the things in the book of Job. That's the way it is. I have no understanding, but that's the way it is. And another midrash that we'll end this section with from Babylonian Talmud Tractate Hagigah, page 5a, Rabbi Yochanan, when he came to the following verse, wept. And thou didst incite me against him to destroy him without cause. That is what God complains to the... That's what God complains to the Satan. You made me do it for no cause. And Rabbi Yochanan, it says he wept when he read that verse. And he said as follows.
The devil made me do it.
God says the devil made me do it.
So that's where Flip Wilson got
it. I'm upset about it. Now understand the syntax of the next sentence that Rabbi Yochanan is saying here. A slave whose master, when they try to incite him against his better judgment, yields. Is there any hope for him? Let me explain. Who is he and
God.
Who are they? There's the slave, that's Job, and that's us, the servants. There's the master, that's God. The they, of course, is the Satan. So the God...
Is the slave Satan?
No. We are the slaves. We are Job and we're the slave. So what happens is there any hope for a servant, that's us, who realizes that his suffering exists only because the master was weak and gave in to the they that tried to incite him? Is there any hope for us? No, we can't. How can we find meaning in the world if that's what we experience? That God is simply weak. And he gives in against his better judgment. That's Rabbi Yochanan speaking. Rabbi Yochanan, who cannot find any meaning, purpose, or rhyme, or reason in his suffering. And he cannot accept any reconciliation, any explanation for the book of Job, except for what it says. It says is, it doesn't make any sense. It's not Olam Haba, because the text doesn't say Olam Haba. It's not a scapegoat, because it doesn't say a scapegoat. It's not sin, because it doesn't say there was any sin. It just is. And Rabbi Yochanan thinks that any explanation, any answer, is much, much worse than the question itself. He's willing to live with the question, live with the dilemma, because he has no answer and no textual resolutions and no midrashim are going to help.
Finally said something worthwhile.
Yes.
He's admitting, in essence, that the that there is irrationality in this dichotomy, and that he's actually admitting that there is no justice because, not justice, there is, I'm searching for the word.
No sense.
Well, that he's admitting that the system, that there's a system for which when things happen to people, it is not controlled by God, it is just happens. It is a system that is devoid then of divine influence. I mean, I think that you could say that he's
well, right. We will certainly see sources that say what you just said, but I'm not sure Rabbi Yochanan said that. I think you put too much into his mouth. If we take the book of Job as it is, God was involved in Job's suffering, but he wasn't involved justly. He was involved, right? He allowed it to happen. It wasn't chance in the book of Job. It was ordained by God, but not with justice. So, again, does that make any sense? No. But that's what the book seems to say.
We cited a passage last year from the prophet Amos that says that we're singled out. We go through, we suffer more and more as expected of us. And so maybe that's maybe you could argue that Job is on a higher level, so more of is expected of him.
Well, that's the scapegoat midrash that we saw last time.
That's true.
Right, that's the scapegoat midrash.
That's true.
So in a way, Rabbi Yochanan was disappointed in God, right?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. He's disappointed in existence as it is. It just doesn't make sense.
Right.
And you know what? I was just thinking that we live in a world in which we see a lot of things that don't make sense. We see a lot of injustice, a lot of pain, a lot of suffering. But the world they lived in 2,000 years ago was so much worse. Even the most basic diseases were not only without a cure, but without any understanding of where they came from. Right? Rabbi Yochanan suffered from scurvy. I mean, we think of scurvy. What do you mean scurvy? Right, just take a Jaffa orange. What's the problem? Right. But they understood nothing of what we understand of the way the world works. And it was really a world in which anything could happen. Your children could die tomorrow, and they usually did. Right? And if you say to yourself, okay, I'll have more, but women died in childbirth. How many, like 30% of women died in childbirth? Am I exaggerating? I'm not sure. But it was a terrible world of unexplained suffering.
No, children, if you look before the beginning of the middle of the 19th century or even later, children are dying constantly.
Left and right.
Whole families would die.
Yeah.
I'm talking about the United States.
Even the United States.
What about the influenza of 1918?
Well,
okay, so now we're beginning today's class. That was an introduction.
You mentioned that Rabbi Yochanan's life sort of kind of paralleled that of Job.
I certainly did.
And because he himself maybe couldn't understand why he, Rabbi Yochanan, a righteous, good person, had such a terrible life, you know, and he couldn't understand why, is the reason that he doubts the whole story of Job.
What word did you use? Doused?
Doubts.
I didn't say doubts. The opposite is the case. He takes the story at face value, that Job really did suffer for no just reason.
Except that he just doesn't understand why. Is that it?
Don't understand, right? But it happened, and it continues happening in my life, says Rabbi Yochanan.
So he's still searching for an answer, right?
Unsuccessfully.
And none of his friends came an answer.
Oh, we'll see. Many of his friends came and tried to give him answers. We'll see that. Okay.
Help us from those friends.
So now we're beginning our second class. And we have, in the next, I'm not sure, 10 weeks, at least 100 different midrashim to see. I try to organize them in some type of framework. And remember again that we're talking about a period of over 500 years, the Talmudic period. We're talking about different rabbis at different times in different lands. When we read one midrash, don't assume anything that you got from a different midrash. We have wildly different points of view here. And in this area, like many other areas, you could never say, the rabbis say, as if there's one opinion in the Talmud or in the midrash or in the Mishnah. It is very, very misleading to say the rabbis say. We're going to see here tens of different rabbis who are at odds with each other.
Right. If I'm out of order, tell me so, and I'll shut up. But I think one of the problems, and this gets back to Bruce's comment about a half an hour ago, the Midrash, yes, it's a collection of different opinions, but at least in some strands of Judaism, it's regarded as sacred literature with the same status as almost of the last two-thirds of this book. You know, the first five books, they're in a special category.
But isn't that only in the eyes of Orthodox rabbis?
No, that's, I'm saying some strands of Judaism. No.
Everyone doesn't feel that way.
In Orthodoxy, the Midrash is sacred literature.
Right.
Wait a second.
Okay. If I'm out of order, you can stop me. You know.
I like very much, or I prefer, as you know, to transcend the denominations of Orthodox, Conservative, and Reform. I would say that anyone who takes Jewish tradition seriously has to take our literature seriously. Our literature is sacred literature. Of course it's sacred literature, whether you're Reform, Conservative, Orthodox. The question is, how do you live with and how do you study sacred literature? Now, as Jews, we study sacred literature critically. It's sacred and it's beloved, it's ours, it's our family, but that doesn't mean that we take it, accept it hook, line, and sinker without critical thinking. We're the people of the book. The people of the book say that Talmud Torah keneged kulam, the study of Torah is equal to all that the mitzvot, and the study of Torah requires use of the mind. If you have five different midrashim and don't realize they're saying five different things, well, you didn't study Torah well. And I would say Reform, Conservative, Orthodox are interested in studying Torah well, which means using your mind to make discernments and to realize who's saying what and where they're disagreeing.
If you don't have the knowledge, you can't dispose of what you don't believe in.
Now, of course, it's true that there are those among the ultra-Orthodox that tend not to want to see the disagreements within our tradition. That's certainly true.
But forget about the word sacred among ultra-Orthodox. That midrashim a tantamount halakha.
That's exactly
because I've had rabbis tell me that.
I'm sorry, didn't
okay.
hear you, Harry.
Well, Yusuf said that
Harry,
some is halakha and some is agadah.
Well, the midrash is divided into the halachic and the agadic, those that deal with what you're supposed to do, mm-hmm. and those that don't deal with what you're supposed to do. And the general rule is that those that deal with what you're supposed to do, they're authoritative. That doesn't mean you do what the midrash says. There might be also conflicting midrash. You have to wait until the halakha makes its decision. Those that don't do what you're supposed to do, simply deal with matters like theology, well, they're giving us options in understanding theology. It could be that you'll find ultra-Orthodox that will say that in matters of theology, there's a decision made. In other words, out of five different midrashic approaches, one has become the accepted one. So with that, I disagree.
That's only
with that, I disagree.
Circle of Orthodox, because the next group over here may have accepted option two instead of option three.
Okay, so I said I disagree with the statement that there is our decisions made in Agadah. The Rambam says clearly, although he also contradicts himself, but the Rambam does say that there are no decisions made in matters of Agadah.
That's written, so to speak.
Okay? Okay.
Unless you're a lit rack and the other one's a belt.
So here we are at the top of this, Jay.
Just one thing. You mentioned the fact that these sources occurred over 500 years during the
period.
And since the printing press wasn't developed until around the 1400s, obviously whatever was written by hand in one place probably never reached the attention of somebody living far away. Is that a fair
statement? That's a fair statement. That's a fair statement.
What one series of thoughts might be may be totally obscure to somebody else dealing with the same problem.
Very good point. Excellent point.
But now we collect them
right.
and put them on these first two handouts.
Very good point. We have a different perspective.
That's old technology. Now we put it on here.
Right. That's really true. Today we have a different perspective of the plethora of possibilities within the Jewish tradition that our rabbis 100 years ago and 1,000 years ago and certainly 2,000 years ago didn't have. Absolutely true. Absolutely true. Okay, so I thought a good way to begin is with this text from Pirkei Avot, from Ethics of the Forefathers. Mm-hmm. Ethics of the Fathers, everyone's heard of Pirkei Avot. And in Pirkei Avot, Rabbi Yanai, who is a Tana, in other words, he's living before the year 200, he's in the time of the Mishnah, Rabbi Yochanan said, it is not in our hands to explain either the contentment of the wicked or the suffering of the righteous. Which of course means that Rabbi Yanai was aware of, he was bothered by the issue that bothers almost everyone before him, he's bothered by it, and he has nothing to answer.
Okay, excuse me.
No good
left
solution.
The book of Job now, right?
We left the book of Job.
Yeah, okay.
Yes.
Okay. But we're looking at the same issues.
The same issues, at least for the next 10 classes.
It's always the same.
It's providence and theodicy in Chazal, right? Not in the Bible like we did last year, but in Chazal.
But you're saying the year 200 Common Era then. He wrote this. He
before the year 200.
This is the same as Rabbi Yohanan.
After the Bar Kokhba
revolt. The truth is, I don't remember Rabbi Yanai when exactly he lived. Rabbi Yanai. I don't remember exactly when he lived.
What's the difference between this that statement and Rabbi Yohanan?
I think it's pretty similar.
Okay.
I think it's pretty similar.
Okay.
Without the pathos, but I think it's pretty similar.
It's the
similar.
Same thing we cry out today. Why me?
Yeah.
It comes right down to that.
So the first midrash that I'm going to bring now that has meat in it is a midrash that we've studied before in a different context, in the context of the philosophy of the oral law, the philosophy of interpretation. Rav Yehuda said in the name of Rav, when Moshe ascended on high, he found the Holy One, blessed be He, engaged in affixing coronets to the letters. So we all know that there's about six letters of the Torah that have crowns on them. In the Torah, the shin has the crowns,
yeah.
Right? Little ornaments that are affixed to the letters, and it doesn't seem to be anything that has any special meaning, certainly not grammatically, certainly not morphologically. Moses was called up by God to spend 40 days and 40 nights on Mount Sinai to receive the Torah. And when Moses got there, God wasn't yet ready to give the Torah because God was doing calligraphy. Said Moses, Lord of the universe, who stays thy hand? And what Moses means to say is, why do I have to wait so long? You know, finish up already. I have something to do. But God is still busy. He answered, this is God speaking. There will arise a man at the end of many generations, Akiva ben Yosef by name, that's Rabbi Akiva, will expound upon each tittle, in other words, each crown, each coronet, heaps and heaps of laws. So God is explaining why it's so important to put these crowns and letters to give Rabbi Akiva something to do. Rabbi Akiva is going to spend a lot of time finding the mystical, hidden interpretation, inference, hint in these crowns. Lord of the universe, said Moses, permit me to see him. This must be a great man that can find meaning in things that I don't see meaning. I want to know him. I want to see him. I want to experience him and talk to him. He replied, and as God said, turn thee around. I'm going to put you in the time tunnel and bring you forward to the time of Rabbi Akiva so you can meet this wonderful man. Moses went and sat down behind eight rows. In other words, there are eight rows in the Beit Midrash where the senior students sit. Moses sat in the back because he's new here. Right? He doesn't have any status in the Beit Midrash or Rabbi Akiva. Not being able to follow their arguments, who is ill at ease. In other words, Moses, the giver of the Torah, doesn't understand what's going on in the Beit Midrash Rabbi Akiva. But when they came to a certain subject and the disciples said to the master, whence do you know it? They said to Rabbi Akiva. And the latter replied, it is a law given unto Moses at Sinai, who was comforted. Without going into the things we talked about last year, the year before, the name of Moses is mentioned by Rabbi Akiva, and then Moses understands that Rabbi Akiva's Torah, even though it's totally unfamiliar to Moses, is connected somehow to the Torah of Moses, so Moses feels better because Rabbi Akiva is part of the chain of tradition. Thereupon, he returned to the Holy One, blessed be He, Moses did, and said, Lord of the universe, thou hast such a man, and thou givest the Torah by me. This Rabbi Akiva is so great, so intelligent, so creative. What a leader. Why did you choose me to get the Torah? You should have chosen Rabbi Akiva. He replied, be silent, for such is my decree. That's the way it is. I'm not explaining to you anything. Perhaps it has reason, perhaps it doesn't, but I'm not explaining, says God to Moses. You're the one. You're getting the Torah. Then said Moses, Lord of the universe, thou hast shown me his Torah. Show me his reward. Turn thee around. And again, Moses goes into the time tunnel, back to the future, to the time of Rabbi Akiva, to see the great, great reward that was given by God to Rabbi Akiva for his greatness in learning and teaching and expounding Torah. And Moses turned around and saw them weighing out his flesh at the market stalls. Because we know that Rabbi Akiva, at the end of his life, was caught by Hadrian, or the representatives of Hadrian, during the time of the Hadrianic persecutions, when it was forbidden to learn Torah, and the Romans took him out to be executed, and his flesh was flayed with combs of iron until his soul expired, and that flesh was sold in the marketplace as food. And that's what God shows Moses as the reward for Rabbi Akiva. Lord of the universe, cried Moses, such Torah and such a reward. He was so great and he did so much, and that's what he gets. He replied, be silent, for such is my decree. That's an amazing midrash.
That's Job.
It's worse than Job, right. It's an amazing midrash. Right? The Midrash could have ended two lines earlier just talking about the greatness of Rabbi Akiva. The Midrash insists on adding these last two lines that God, as it were, you know, God doesn't even hide the fact. Why did God have to tell Moses what's going to happen to Rabbi Akiva?
Because he's an unjust God.
It doesn't say that he's unjust. Perhaps you're right. Perhaps you're right. But all it says is that God... Well, then let me make this clear. See those hands? Look at the last two words of this Midrash. My decree. In other words, the Midrash doesn't claim that it's all random.
Right.
It doesn't claim that God doesn't have a hand in what happens. The Midrash claims something much worse. That God does have a hand in it, and it's God's will that Rabbi Akiva get what he got. We don't see the meaning in it, and God doesn't deem it proper to reveal the meaning in it. I just want to continue. Excuse me, Harry, just a little bit more. And again, God could have hidden this from Moses. Mm-hmm. But no, he doesn't hide it. He actually flaunts it. In other words, God wants Moses to know that this world, and even the world of Torah and of Judaism, with the covenant with God, even this world, is a world in which you will not see what you would expect as a reward for your goodness. It's going to be an ugly world, and a seemingly unjust and cruel world. But you should know, it's all part of my plan, says God.
What I think Prophet Judah is trying to bring out is, very simply, that God is God, and whatever God does, and don't question it. I don't buy it, but that's what I get from this.
Okay. Okay. Chip and then Dorothy?
Rabbi Akiva, though, considered his suffering as an opportunity to say the Shema with all my soul. And so in a way, that it was... Rabbi Akiva considered it a good thing. So in a way, it's a good thing that God showed Moses.
Chip is making a good point.
What's that? I couldn't understand.
Chip is pointing out that there are other Midrashim, in which Rabbi Akiva finds deep meaning in his own suffering. But I want to point out to Chip that is missing from this Midrash, right? Don't conflate the Midrashim.
Okay.
Rabbi Akiva, in a certain sense, and excuse me for my audacity, Rabbi Akiva is disagreeing with the way God is portrayed in this Midrash. In this Midrash, God says, it's my decree and be silent. In a different Midrash, that we're going to read in the future, Rabbi Akiva says, it's not a decree, it makes perfect sense to me.
There's a parallel.
I'm exaggerating, of course.
And then the parallel in this Midrash about keep silent when Aaron lost his two sons, Nadab and Abihu, mm-hmm. he was silent, the text says.
Mm-hmm.
Something to be silent in confronting the divine decree.
Right, there's one approach that says be silent.
Could it have something to do with Akiva, excuse me, proclaiming Bahopa as the Messiah before God said he was the Messiah? Was he taking a stand before time?
So if you're saying that perhaps there was some sin there,
yeah.
But this Midrash does not talk
right,
about sin.
That's
does not.
Thinking.
So that's something else.
So that's another stuff.
Something else.
Yeah.
Dorothy, and then over here.
Well, the question that I have is would we remember Akiva the way we do if he hadn't been martyred? I mean, it's in God's plan to martyr Akiva. It isn't necessarily that he punished him, but he used him to wake up people around him to, you know, to what God's plan was. So he's telling Moses, don't question my plan. I have a reason for everything I do. And I want people to remember Akiva.
Could be.
I mean, would we really remember Rabbi Akiva the same way if he hadn't been martyred? I doubt it. He would have been another great rabbi of Omeni.
I'm not sure that's true. He really is head and shoulders above many in the Mishnaic literature.
His martyrdom, I think, just made it even
Okay. Let me go here to Bruce, then we'll come back.
We start out, and I'm sort of left hanging here. with something important about the crowns,
and then we sort of forget
we never get any definitions or any answers. Is this just something thrown in?
Well, that's for the discussion of 2 years ago when we talked about the philosophy of Torah Shebaal Peh based on this Midrash. So let's just forget about that for now, for this year.
But also, this is a terribly upsetting Midrash, and it seems to be written by somebody who loves sadism, masochism, violence, blood and gore.
Bruce, perhaps is written by someone who lives in reality. And is not able to deny that reality.
Okay.
Because just imagine living in the time of Rabbi Akiva with the Hadrianic persecutions. Mm-hmm. All of the greatest men are being slaughtered. They're being taken by the Romans and in front of cheering mobs in the Colosseum and the amphitheaters, they're being slaughtered. And it looks like the Holocaust. It looks like there's no rhyme and there's no reason. That's the world. They're living in a time of Holocaust.
No, but there's no Palestinians yet. There may have been Arabs, but they were...
They're Romans.
But
it was the Romans that named it Philistine.
It was part of... They named it Palestine.
Philistine.
Because there were Philistines there.
You've always got to take into account you can't divorce theology from reality or history, because partially, to a large degree, because of Rabbi Akiva's actions, we had one of the greatest disasters in Jewish history from the Holocaust revolt.
Mm-hmm.
It's 600,000 to 700,000. Yeah. vast majority of the Jews in Israel were killed by the Romans.
Yeah.
So how can we always keep saying how great Rabbi Akiva was without also recognizing the direct result of his actions?
We lost Israel.
The Bar Kokhba rebellion is what really led the Romans to their...
And that's
true.
Rabbi Akiva was the one that strongly supported it.
Yeah, it was Rabbi Tarfon who told Akiva, grass will grow in your cheeks before the Messiah.
Okay, this is a different subject. It's an important subject.
It's but it's a cause.
Different subject.
It's a cause. He was an irritant.
But it certainly it gives credence to the that they would use the rabbis living shortly after that time, within 100 or 200 years, would use that kind of imagery. Selling of the...
Yeah.
It's awful, but it reflected a certain reality.
Okay, another source. Babylonian Talmud Tractate Brachot, page 7a. Rabbi Yochanan, and this is Rabbi Yochanan that we
again
recognize,
yes.
Further said in the name of Rabbi Yose, three things did Moses ask of the Holy One, blessed be He, and they were granted to him. He asked that the divine presence should rest upon Israel, and it was granted him. For it is said, is it not in...
Is it not in that
thou goest up with us, that we are so distinguished, I and thy people, from all the people that are upon the face of the earth? That's from Exodus chapter 33. He asked that the divine presence should not rest upon the idolaters, and it was granted him. For it is said, so that we are distinguished, I and thou people. Okay, fine. He asked that he should show him the ways of the Holy One, blessed be He, and it was granted to him. For it is said, show me now thy ways. Harinina et rachecha. Moses said before him, Lord of the universe, why is it that some righteous men prosper and others are in adversity? Some wicked men prosper and others are in adversity. So according to the Midrash, Moses asked God the big question of why do bad things happen to good people? And it was Moses' third request of God, and Moses got an answer to all three, including this last one, this big one. He replied to him, the answer of God to Moses, why do the righteous suffer, was as follows. Moses, The righteous man who prospers is the righteous man, the son of a righteous man. The righteous man who is in adversity is a righteous man, the son of a wicked man.
Yeah.
The wicked man who prospers is a wicked man, son of the righteous man. The wicked man who is in adversity is a wicked man, son of a wicked man.
It takes us back to 10 generations, 20
right.
generations.
So let's try and examine what we just read. This is Rabbi Yochanan speaking. This is the Rabbi Yochanan that is living the life of pain and suffering, at least at one point, and doesn't understand what's going on. This is the Rabbi Yochanan that identifies with the book of Job, with the main character of Job. And according to Rabbi Yochanan, Moses got an answer. He got an answer to the big question.
It all depends on your father.
Well, it depends who your father was. So, if we try and look at this answer, what's implicit in this answer is that although there may be justice, it's not justice that looks only at you. There are factors beyond your control. Your father and your mother, perhaps your grandfather, perhaps your great-great-grandfather, perhaps going back at least 3 or 4 generations, if we think of the verses in the Torah.
But it doesn't say, it just says father.
That's what it says, right. Yeah. But remember, we remember verses in the Torah that talk about God punishing for 3 or 4 generations, and it looks like that this Midrash is taking that literally. Where else would he get the idea of the father? So where does that leave me as an individual looking for justice? It means that I could be the greatest in the world, and I'll be punished for what my father or grandfather, great-grandfather did. That's not very comforting. It might make sense in the context that we've talked about of expanded identity, collective identity, hashkacha pratit that is really hashkacha klalit, right? Individual providence that's really collective providence, and I'm just a cog, I'm just one element there, and I'm going to suffer, it may be, for no good reason. So, on the one hand, Rabbi Yochanan has God given an answer, but it's an answer that's really no answer as far as the individual is concerned. The master said above. So now we have a later rabbi commenting on what Rabbi Yochanan said in the Midrash we just read. The master said above, the righteous man who prospers is a righteous man, son of a righteous man. The righteous man who is in adversity is a righteous man, son of a wicked man. But this is not so. That's what Rabbi Yochanan said, that God said to Moses, can't be. For lo, one verse says, visiting the iniquity of the fathers upon the children. We know that verse from the Ten Commandments. And that's probably the one that Rabbi Yochanan is basing himself upon. But another verse says, neither shall the children be put to death for the fathers. Right? That's a contradictory verse we also saw 2 years ago. And a contradiction was pointed out between these two verses, and the answer was given, there's no contradiction. The one verse deals with children who continue in the same course as their fathers, and the other verse with children who do not continue in the course of their fathers. When it says, you're not punished for the sins of your fathers, that's when you repented and are not acting like your fathers. When the verse says that you are punished for the sins of your fathers, that's only when you continued acting like your fathers. So in other words, what was being quoted here is a midrash, a different midrash, that took the contradiction in the verse and reconciled it in a fashion that did away with the idea of a righteous man being punished for the sins of his ancestors. You know, hear what I'm saying? That this is a prior midrash that did away with any concept of a man being punished, a good man being punished for the sins of his ancestors. That's only when you continue the sins of your ancestors. So now we're saying, how could Rabbi Yochanan have said that God said to Moses, there is punishment of a righteous man for his wicked father, when a Midrash already said there is no such thing? What we have here is a conflict between two different Midrashim. Rabbi Yochanan's Midrash, that claims that a righteous man is punished for the sin of his fathers, and a different Midrash that here isn't given the name of a rabbi, that claims there's no such thing. There's never going to be punishment of righteous man for the sins of his forefathers. Now we understand Rabbi Yochanan's position. Rabbi Yochanan lives in a world in which he doesn't see justice. So he attributes it to the fact that you're being punished for previous generations. Things you can't see and can't understand. Nothing Midrash says there's no such thing. There's no such thing. Only the evil are punished. So it really is Rabbi Yochanan being consistent. Now, what are we going to do now? Well, the text we're reading assumes that the Midrash that did away with the righteous being punished for the sins of their fathers assumes that's the authoritative one, and therefore Rabbi Yochanan's Midrash has to be reinterpreted. Here we go.
But it's so opposite of what I consider Judaism today is be good, and that's your reward right there, is doing the right thing.
We have many things to study until we might get to an approach like that. You must therefore say, right, in reconciling the previous Midrash with Rabbi Yochanan's Midrash, you must therefore say that the Lord said thus to Moses, different than Rabbi Yochanan said.
Mm-hmm. We're still on that.
8 lines from the
end
of the Midrash. It might be 10 lines. A righteous man who prospers is a perfectly righteous man. The righteous man who is in adversity is not a perfectly righteous man. The wicked man who prospers is not a perfectly wicked man. The wicked man who's in adversity is a perfectly wicked man. In other words, whereas Rabbi Yochanan said that a perfectly righteous man could be punished by God because of the sins of his forefathers, the opposing opinion says, no, that can't be. If a righteous man suffers, it's because he's not perfectly righteous and he has some personal sins. Of course, Rabbi Yochanan is going to say, no, that can't be. It's contradicted by the book of Job, and it's contradicted, says Rabbi Yochanan, by my life, because I know that the way I suffered so terribly, it can't be because of any sins that I did. So we have the same thing again. We have one position that claims that there's justice for each individual, and if you suffer, it must be because you sin. And Rabbi Yochanan says, I can't buy that. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, this saying of Rabbi Yochanan is in opposition to the saying of Rabbi Meir. For Rabbi Meir said, only 2 requests were granted him, right? Moses made 3. Rabbi Yochanan said all 3 were granted. Rabbi Meir says only 2 are granted, and 1 was not granted to him. For it is said, and I will be gracious to whom I will be gracious, although he may not deserve it. And I will show mercy in whom I will show mercy, although he may not deserve it. So this verse that Rabbi Meir is quoting, which is in the same context as the previous verses about the 3 requests, this verse is interpreted to mean the following, that God said to Moses, if you ask me, why do the righteous sometimes suffer and the evil prosper, the answer is, I'm not telling you. The answer is, I'll be gracious, and it doesn't look to you like it's just, I'm not explaining it to you.
I am what I am.
Well, it's like a parent saying, because I'm your parent, I'm your mother, that's why I'm telling you to do it.
Okay. So what comes out of all this? Out of this Midrash? What comes out of this Midrash is 3 opinions. The opinion that says that Moses was granted an answer to his 3rd question of why do the righteous prosper? I'm sorry, why do the righteous suffer and the evil prosper? And the answer is because there's always hidden sin or hidden justice. Hidden sin or hidden iniquity. Mm-hmm. If someone suffers, it's because they sinned. You might not see the sin, but it's there. If someone prospers, it's because they had righteousness. You might not see the righteousness, but it's there. That's the first answer. The second answer is Rabbi Yochanan, who says, no, that's not true. Someone who's totally righteous can still suffer, and it's because of his ancestors. But for that particular person, it's not individually just. And the third answer is that there's no answer. The third answer is that God said, I'm not telling you. That God said, although he may not deserve it, there are things that happen that are just not deserved. I'm not explaining to you any further.
In Hebrew, isn't that kaha?
Yeah.
Or is it besher?
Well, I don't know what that means. What is meant to be?
It
sounds like Rabbi Yochanan contradicts himself.
Explain.
I mean, in before we said, you know, that when you're talking about Job, just couldn't be, and I don't know the answer, and so therefore it's, you know, unanswerable.
Right.
And then here he's saying that there is an answer, and that it's, so that doesn't sound consistent.
So let me say the following. All of these texts have been redacted. They've been passed on orally. There are different versions sometimes of the same midrash or the same story. And it will happen that we'll find blatant contradictions. Rabbi Yochanan says X here and Y here. It's two different Rabbi Yochanan. So they're two different memories, perhaps, of what Rabbi Yochanan actually said. Or perhaps there is development from year to year. He lived a long time. We will find such things. And in this particular case, I think we have found a great affinity between the two Rabbi Yochanans, a great affinity. But Joe is right. We've also found a little difference here. There's a great affinity because in both cases, Rabbi Yochanan will not accept the approach that says that there really is individual justice. That if the righteous suffer, it's because they sinned. Rabbi Yochanan, in both cases, rejects that. And Rabbi Yochanan is left saying that there isn't individual justice. Now, going one step further, Joe is right. There is a slight difference. In one case, he just puts up his arms and says, I don't understand. In another case, he attributes it to the sin of previous generations. Yeah. I think we have time for a little bit more. For a famous story of Rabbi Chanina ben Dosa. Rabbi Chanina ben Dosa was known to be not necessarily the greatest hacham, the greatest sage, but he's known to be a tzaddik and a miracle worker. A miracle worker. We're going back to the time of the Tanaim here, to the time of the Mishnah. And in the Babylonian Talmud, Tractate Brachot, page 33a, we read as follows. Our rabbis taught in a braita, in a certain place there was once a viper that used to injure people. They came to Rabbi Chanina ben Dosa, he said to them, show me its hole. They showed him its hole and he put his heel over the hole. The viper came out, bit Rabbi Chanina, and died. Who died? The viper died. Rabbi Chanina put it on his shoulder, brought it to the house of study, and said to them, I see my typing here is full of mistakes. See, my sons, it is not the viper that kills, it is sin that kills. So this is the classic statement of what is considered to be the traditional approach that says there is no suffering without sin. And really, everything that happens in the world is a function of God's ledger. If you get bit by the viper, it's not because vipers are poisonous.
But it's a fact.
No, it's not a fact. This viper was not poisonous when it bit Rabbi Chanina.
The vipers are among the most poisonous snakes in the world.
No, they're not.
Yes, they are.
It's just that human beings are sinful.
Well.
And God uses a viper to punish them. But when the viper bites a totally righteous person, nothing happens to them.
You actually believe that, don't you, huh?
I'm doing very good, I think, if you think I believe that, Harry. But Harry, again, this is not about belief. This is about, let me say it differently.
It's a belief system.
It's not about our beliefs. It's about examining the beliefs that are found within our tradition.
Do you think this is a dangerous teaching? In other words, it's a dangerous teaching because Frank was among the most poisonous snakes in the world. And someone who reads it says, well, I'm not going to worry about being bit by a viper because I'm a good person. God will save me, like he saved Rabbi whatever his name is.
Hanina Bendosa.
It's a dangerous story.
Harry, there is a place in my soul that deeply identifies with what you're saying. There really is. I'm still saying seriously. But traditionally speaking, looking at Jewish history, this story has not been dangerous because no one is willing to attribute to themselves the same level of righteousness that was held by Rabbi Hina ben Dosa. There's no man in the world that's totally righteous and doesn't sin. And there are many, I'm not telling you my belief, but there are many following this story that tell you that when the viper bites and someone is injured, it's because that person has some sin. We all have some sin. Wow. But were it to bite a totally righteous person, then the viper would die.
And you believe that? Huh?
Harry!
Well, come on! Let's be at least somewhat.
Okay, it's not about our beliefs here. We're studying Jewish tradition. And let me tell you something, Harry. And this is very important. Were I... Look, you think I didn't know how Harry would react?
And we say this just for you until you can.
Were I to compile this source sheet without this story, without the similar stories, I would be doing you a great disservice. I wouldn't be showing you the full breadth of Jewish tradition. I'd be hiding something that I can't hide. I don't want to hide. I want us to study what our tradition says, and our tradition says many things. Some of them are more palatable to you, some are more palatable to someone else.
But the danger is, if I were a real firm Yid, I would buy this. You see, when I was a little boy growing up, I bought it all. But I'm not a little boy anymore.
Did you think you were free from sin?
Huh?
Did you think you were totally free from sin?
No,
then you wouldn't
then you
put your heel
on the hole.
No. The point is, well, I believed everything that they taught me.
Harry,
I find that very difficult to believe. That's why I'm saying this is a dangerous statement for a believer.
I would say that it's dangerous when the Jewish tradition is presented as that one story and nothing else.
It would also be dangerous if you were arrogant enough to believe that you were without any sin at all. And I don't think anybody would accept that.
No, it's not as dangerous.
I'm sure Mother Teresa believed that she had some sin in her.
All right, so the main thing is if you've got a kid who's going to go camping, you don't put your head near a bush or a rock.
Right,
don't stick
it in the oven and
the gas. It's a parable.
That's all.
But I understand.
It's like Aesop's fable. Like the story about the boy who cried wolf.
To an innocent kid.
The point that it makes.
Right. Listen to Mo, okay?
The point that it makes is the last statement. That's, he wants to make a point
here.
That's
why the viper died.
Mm-hmm. It's not the viper, it's sin that kills.
Because he was righteous.
Right? It's sin that kills.
That's
were we not to sin, we would not die.
We also wouldn't enjoy life.
No, it doesn't say that.
This is true.
It might say that.
We certainly wouldn't
enjoy
life if we didn't.
Okay. This is certainly part of our tradition. We'll see many other statements that say that there is justice. Just like we saw earlier, there are those who say that there is absolute justice and suffering and death are only a result of sin. Let's see one more source before we go because it's basically the same thing. Unfortunately, I didn't put a space between the Midrash we just read and the one we're about to read. This is from the Mechilta, which is the rabbinic halachic commentary on the book of Exodus. On the bottom of the page, right below the one about the viper. Again, I did not leave a space there, unfortunately.
Not tonight, no.
Rabbi Yishmael ben Elisha, the high priest. He was the Kohen Gadol. and Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel were on their way out to be killed by the Romans. When Rabban Shimon said to Rabbi Ishmael, "Rabbi, my heart goes out, for I do not know why I am being killed." Now he knew why the Romans captured him for teaching Torah. But he didn't understand the deeper why. Why is God allowing this? The assumption being that God is in charge. Rabbi Ishmael said to Rabbi Shimon, "Has it ever happened that a person came to you for judgment and wanted a halakhic judgment, or with a question, and you delayed him until you swallowed what's in your bag? You having lunch? Or until you tied your sandal, until you wrapped yourself in your shawl? Remember the Torah says, 'You shall not ill-treat any widow or orphan. If you do mistreat them in any way, and they cry out to me, I will surely hear their cry.'" So Rabbi Shimon is saying, there's a reason why God is punishing us. We must have sinned. Even if we made someone wait for 5 seconds before dealing with them and helping them, that's a sin. And God, of course, is exacting with his righteous according to a hair's breadth. And for us, it might have been a terrible sin that brings us to death just for delaying the help we'd give to a widow or an orphan for 10 seconds. And for this explanation, Rabban Shimon said to him, "You have comforted me, Rabbi. You've explained to me, now I understand. Now I can go to my death with a sense of acceptance, because you're right, I did sin in this fashion." And again, the idea is there is no suffering without sin. It's all punishment, not for previous generations according to this, but punishment for my own personal sin.
But this whole, that rationale seems so, is so ridiculous, because make the connection between waiting for a orphan for a minute as opposed to the Romans killing you. There's absolutely no connection, so to come up with this type of thing makes one question the whole rationale.
There isn't.
I certainly hear what you're saying. And like I said to Harry, it's a place in my soul that identifies with what you're saying.
I can see the two rabbis going to the death, one nudges the other, "Hey, did you go shopping on Shabbat?" something we can relate to, at least.
But the truth is, they really were very righteous. They could think of nothing they did wrong, but they cannot accept the fact that their deaths might not be divinely ordained according to the strictest sense of Judges, and now they found an explanation. And for them, it's better than no explanation.
It reminds me of a scene in with Mark Antony speaking to the Senate and saying, for so are they all honorable men. There is no such thing.
Well,
okay. We'll finish up with a few comments over here.
I had a situation in Jerusalem on Shabbos the last time we were there. We were in a market near Meshurim. We were just buying stuff for Shabbos. There were about 10 people in front of me checking out.
They blew the horn, I said.
No.
Oh.
And this man wearing a big hat, a black coat down to his ankles, went to push to the head of the line. Mm-hmm. And I hit him right in the pit of the stomach with my elbow.
Yes.
What did he do? Who was...
You're righteous.
Am I the righteous one? Because he was trying to get there before the other people standing in line.
Before the shofar blew.
I don't know.
I know. I mean, this is a... You're so...
Jay.
Huh?
You're Jay.
Suppose we take the text as it is, but instead of the very last phrase, "You have comforted me," I think that that it's worthy to consider the other alternative. "You have not comforted me," because, as Jim said, I think it was, that the punishment is so outrageously exaggerated compared to the, quote, sin, which is so trivial. And therefore, I would say that it doesn't comfort me to know that whatsoever, and that this doesn't hold much value as far as explaining at all. You know, quite the contrary. It makes me not want to believe
that there is any divine justice.
Mm-hmm. I understand. I really do. I really do.
And as the rabbis would say, now let us pray.
Shana Tava.
Shana Tava. Are you going to Israel for the holidays?
No.